Hi, this is Derek from Atlanta. Unlike Bob, I am a former law enforcement officer, but I still enjoy listening to a practical show by a practical guy. You're listening to the Handgun World Podcast.
Hi folks, Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This is episode number 355. This is a practical show. I'm a practical everyday guy. I do a little bit of firearms training on the side, but I don't have a military or law enforcement background. I don't have a gunsmithing background or, you know, medical personnel background or anything like that. I'm not an ex-fireman or anything. Just an everyday dude, and boy, I tell you what, I sure take my self-defense seriously, my Second Amendment rights seriously, and of course, I believe that the Second Amendment was founded for a very particular reason, and that is to preserve the liberty of individuals that are American citizens, to give us the ability to fight back, to protect ourselves against tyrannies, and to preserve our liberty. And that also, I believe, helps protect your God-given right to defend yourself. So, with all that said, this week I had a chance to do another interview. You know, I've been asked to do more interviews, and this is like the fourth interview in the last 5 or 6 weeks that I've put out for you. And I'm probably got another one coming up next week. So, you know, if you remember a few weeks ago, I did a podcast episode on shooting eyesight, and I ran across an excellent article that Grant Cunningham wrote in Concealed Carry magazine, I think is where I saw it. And, you know, I've been struggling with my eyesight because my prescription recently changed. And, you know, we don't always have to use sights when we shoot, but there are times when we do use sights. And mine have been a little bit blurry lately, so I ran across the article. I talked about it. This episode is part two of Shooting Eyesight. I got a chance to interview Grant Cunningham, and it was really cool. He reached out to me because I think he heard my other podcast and so forth, and he said, hey, why don't we do an interview on it? I thought, great idea. And I've never had Grant on this show before. Grant is a very well-known author, a renowned trainer. He's a revolver guru, a lever-action rifle guru, a target threat teacher, and so forth. And, you know, you'll hear more about Grant when we do the interview. He's on the Gun Nation podcast. Grant is very, very well-known and highly respected in the firearms community. So this is some good information, and I think you're going to enjoy. Let's get going with my interview with Grant Cunningham. Joining me this episode for an interview is Grant Cunningham. Grant's an author and a podcast. He's a podcast guest, an author, a trainer, all kinds of good stuff like that on self-defense and handguns, aren't you?
My primary area of interest is teaching people how to defend themselves with firearms, particularly handguns. And as a result, I also do some consulting around the industry for companies that are looking to produce products to address that market as well.
I saw your author page on Amazon, Grant, and that's pretty good. You got quite a few books out there.
Yeah, I've got 6 out right now, 5 in dead tree format, as we call it, and then one that was electronic, and all those are through Gun Digest Books.
How long have you been writing?
I'd have to look at the publication date for the first book, but gosh, I've been writing a blog now for about 8 years, and that's really where I started writing. And then my first book was published, let's see, 4 years ago, I think now, something like that, 5 years ago, something like that.
That's great. I'm honored to have you on the show, Grant. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
I first heard about you as, of course, the revolver guru. You know, and I think the very first time I actually heard you speak was you were on the Gun Nation podcast, I believe.
That wouldn't surprise me. I spent a lot of time there.
And you have been on there now the last couple of years quite a bit.
Yes. I became a regular along with Doc Wesson and, of course, Average Joe.
Doc? Who's that?
Yeah, Doc Wesson? Who's that? We have to get – this is – for anybody that's listening that doesn't know the joke, we always have to get Doc's name in. Anybody in the podcasting world has to get Doc's name in.
Well, it's so much fun to say his name, Doc Wesson.
Doc Wesson.
You know, he's probably getting a good chuckle out of this. I know he listens occasionally. He's probably, you know, just chuckling right now.
I hope so.
Well, Grant, you know, you reached out to me because I came across one of your articles. I'm pretty sure it was in Concealed Carry Magazine about eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a great article. It's one of the reasons why I did a podcast on it. And so this is kind of like, you know, a follow-up. And it's great to have you on because I'm in the position where a lot of listeners are. I'm 54. My eyesight is not anywhere close to what it used to be. And I'm kind of having to teach myself all over again.
That happened to me. My eyesight started going in my mid-30s. I'm 55 now. And my eyesight started going into my early 30s. And it sort of went all at once, right? One day I was seeing just fine, and the next day it's like, wow, I can't read. I have to hold things out at the end of my arms to read and all that sort of thing. I went to the optometrist, and right out of the bat, I had bifocals. That's how bad my eyes have gotten, and they haven't gotten any better since.
Well, me too. I got bifocals, you know, the fancy kind, the progressives.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, but still, the same thing. All of a sudden, the sights are blurry, but I really liked what you said. You know, it's kind of like you have to accept blurry sights. You got to look through them. And I see a nice, crisp, clear, in-focus target.
Yeah, so do I. In fact, most of what happens with most people as they age, of course, they do have problems focusing close in. I mean, that's the first thing to go. The joke is, wow, I have to hold things out at arm and length to read. And that's what happened as we age. Our eyes have less accommodation, which means that they can't focus in as close as they used to. And even without my glasses, generally a target at, say, 5 yards or 6 yards is generally fairly sharp, or at least as sharp as it's ever going to get. And yeah. It's the stuff in close, the stuff at arm's length that's all of a sudden blurry. I'm sitting here now. If I take my glasses off and I look at my hand, in fact, my hand is right at the distance to my computer screen that I'm looking at right now. And I cannot read a word on the computer screen, even the big headlines. I can't read a darn thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, I can't read a thing. And so I have to put my glasses on just to be able to see at that distance. And so for me, trying to see something at the end of my arms, unless I use my bifocals, just isn't going to happen.
And if you think about it, at the end of your arms, those are your pistol sights.
That's where your pistol sights are. And so what happens is those of us that when our eyes are starting to go and we try to use the pistol sights, one of two things has to happen. Either A, one of three things actually. The first one is we have glasses custom made so we can shoot, which is kind of a silly thing to do when we're talking about defensive situations because you might not always have those. And I mean, some people even go to the length of having bifocals put on the top.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Which, of course, looks silly when you're wearing them around, so you typically don't wear those unless you're at the range shooting, and so now you get into a defensive situation. You don't have your special glasses on. Now you can't see your sights. The other thing, the number two, we tilt our heads back to try to get the bifocal into a position where we can use the sights. And aside from just looking absolutely silly and people on the range will make fun of you, I don't think it's going to happen in a defensive shooting incident because it's relatively difficult. In fact, I'm tilting my head back now and I'm pretending I'm looking through my sights. It's relatively difficult to get the sights and the target and my bifocals aligned in anything sort of a reasonable time frame, and it also puts us into sort of an upright standing position, which is not congruent with good recoil control when we're talking about shooting realistic strings of fire. So that leaves us with number three. We accept the fact that our sights are going to be blurry, and we do something else.
Yeah, and I think I think the best thing that you said in the article that you wrote was that it's kind of a misnomer that people think that they have to have sights completely in focus to make a hit on the target.
Yeah, and this is something that even after I got my glasses for years, I suffered with not being able to shoot very well. And my shooting got worse and worse. I mean, unless I can use my bifocals or get glasses cut for that prescription or something. Mm. And I got to thinking about it one day and thought about it in terms of geometry. And I came to the conclusion that to a large extent, it doesn't matter what's in focus as long as something is. And the reason for this is there, when we talk about shooting with sights, for those situations where we need the precision that our sights give us,
right,
there are two sources of error, two sources of deviation. And the first is in our sight alignment. In other words, how the front sight goes into the rear sight, with an even amount of light on the sides and even on the top and all that kind of thing.
Sure.
And technically that's called superpositioning. From the term superpose. And so we have that error. So if you make an error in aligning your sights, of course you'll have deviation on the target. And the other form of deviation on the target is superimposition, which is usually referred to as sight picture, which is the placement of our aligned sights on the target. So we have two possible areas where we can have deviation, in the sight alignment or in the sight placement, one or the other.
Okay. Didn't look at it that way before.
Yeah, so what we're doing typically, if we focus on the front sight, what we're doing is saying, okay, we're going to reduce the sight alignment error, the superposition error, to the greatest degree possible. But we're going to accept the fact that because the target is blurry, we can't see it real well. So we're going to accept a little bit of placement error or superimposition error at the target. And so back in what this all comes down to is back in the days, of course, when we looked at target shooting and bullseye shooting and that sort of thing, what they would typically do is make the targets very high contrast. You would have this nice black circle with nice clean paper around it.
Yeah.
And what we would do is we would adjust our sights so that if we held the front sight on the bottom edge of that circle and adjusted them so that the bullets hit in the center of the circle, that's the origin of the 6 o'clock hold. That's where it comes from.
That's where it comes from, yeah.
We could take advantage of that tremendous contrast and reduce our superimposition error. So by focusing on the front sight, we've reduced the alignment error. And by making this nice high contrast target and putting our sights at the bottom of it, we reduce the placement error. Well, we don't get to do that in defensive shooting, right? We don't have that nice sort of high contrast thing that we can adjust our sights at known distances. And so that doesn't work very well. So now what we've got is when we're talking about reduced visual acuity, now we have to choose. What happens if we decide, okay, we're going to allow some alignment error because the sights are fuzzy and we can't do anything about it? How about if we focus on the target and reduce the placement error to the greatest degree possible? And in practice, both with myself and with my students, what we find is the two roughly are equivalent. What we find very typically is that the people who start shooting with a target focus end up shooting about as well as they ever did. In fact, my shooting actually improved a little bit when I started doing this. And mainly because we're simply trading error. We're trading that superposition error for the superimposition error. And that's all we're doing. So as long as something's in focus, as long as we can reduce one of those errors, we can shoot well.
And that's an interesting way to put it. I've never really looked at it that way. Thank you for teaching me that. That's interesting.
Well, and this, what happens is that once we, the hardest part of this whole thing is for those people like me, and like most shooters, where we were trained and sort of hit over the head, always focus on your front sight, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what you always talk. Focus on the front
sight. I was trained that.
Yeah, focus on the front sight. The hardest thing to do is to train ourselves not to do that, to keep our focus, in fact, on the target or on the threat, and when we're talking about defensive shooting. And that's the hardest thing part about it. What's interesting is that when most people start to, and this is one of those things that when I have a class and I start to teach people this and they start hitting the target, they go, wow, I didn't think that was possible. Well, yeah, it is. Yeah. One of the interesting things is that when we start shooting at distance, one of the things that I do typically is in a lot of my classes, if I have the facilities to do it, I'll stick a steel target out at like 60 or 70 yards, and I'll have the students shoot it with a target focus. Now, one of the interesting things is if you're focused on the front sight and your target is, let's say, 5 yards away, I focus on the front sight. The front sight is always the same level of sharpness, but as the target gets moved out, the target gets fuzzier and fuzzier and fuzzier, right? Mm-hmm. So that the difference in the fuzziness of the target at 5 yards and the distance in the target fuzziness at 25 yards is quite a bit different. When we're focused on the target, and once we're beyond about 5 yards, which is optical infinity for the human optical system, once we get to optical infinity, our eyes are pretty much in focus all the time. So if I'm focused on the target at, say, 5 yards, my sights are, let's say, some level of blurriness, like level 3.
They should be blurry.
Right. If I move that target out to 50 yards, the target's still in focus, and my sights are still level 3 blurriness. In other words, the amount of correction I need to make because of the blurriness doesn't change. It does change if you're focused on your front sight because the target gets blurrier as it goes out. So what most people find is that it actually becomes, paradoxically, it becomes actually easier to shoot at distance with a target focus than it did when they were actually focused on the front sight, or they could focus on their front sight.
Well, I've been noticing that, and you know, I've been going through the same progression as you did. I've had to transition to looking at a target that's completely in focus, where in the past it was not. In the past, my sight was in focus, but the target was blurry.
Right.
And now what I'm finding, Grant, what I think is really interesting is that, you know, I'm thinking, okay, what if this is a real bad guy? Okay, what if I'm in a situation where I've got to defend myself? I actually want the bad guy to be in focus. I want to be able to see everything. And that's probably what my mind's going to do anyway, right?
Exactly, actually. And this is one of the things that has come, I don't want to say that it has come after I started doing this, but sort of concurrently with it, as I started taking a look at what the science of our visual systems is and how our visual systems react when we're under a lethal threat. Because we have these natural threat reactions that occur. And there are changes in hormone levels in the blood, changes in blood flow. And the net result of all those is that there's a change in blood flow in our eyes. Now, interesting enough, our eyes have two sources of blood, and they do different things. And what happens under a lethal threat reaction, that natural threat reaction, is that we lose accommodation in our eye. Strangely enough, much like we lose accommodation as our eyes age, they focus at infinity so that to focus on the threat, to gather the maximum amount of information about that threat, it's a survival instinct. It's something that is built in, that we do naturally. And so focusing on the threat, focusing on the target, is actually congruent with what we know from science our eyes are likely to do when we're really attacked. And this really came home when I was studying the work of Lou Kyoto. And Lou was the head of training for the California Highway Patrol back in the 80s and 90s. He's probably most famous for his target-focused training system, and he was radical at that time. You know, this was the era of the modern technique and focusing hard on the front side, all this sort of stuff. And here comes Lou Kyoto down at CHP. And telling everybody, no, this is silly, because he had in his hands some early scientific information that said, yeah, your eye's probably not going to do that. And then he pointed out that, you know, in order to make good decisions, we have to have information about our threat. The only way we're going to get information about our threat is to look at them.
Yeah, exactly.
And the only way we're going to do that is to keep our focus on the target.
Well, that's what I say. I want to have as much information about what is this bad guy doing. So I kind of like it that the target now is in crystal clear focus.
Exactly. You can gather the greatest amount of information that you need about what he's doing, rather than, you know, looking at it through sites that might be blurry. And again, it's not just, and I tell my students this all the time, it's not just, gathering information to be able to shoot. But we also need to be able to assess as we're shooting. You know, do I need to shoot this guy? Do I need to shoot him again? Do I need to keep shooting? Do I need to stop shooting? Right? That's
part of it. Now there's a concept that people don't talk about much.
Exactly.
When do you stop shooting?
When do you stop shooting? Is he giving up? Has he dropped his gun and say, man, don't shoot me anymore? Yeah. Is somebody walked in front of him or behind him or something? Has something changed about that? And the only way you're going to know about that is if you're assessing as you're shooting. The only way to do that is to focus on the threat, focus on the target.
Yeah, has an innocent person walked in front of him or behind him, or is an innocent person about to step in front of him any second now? You want to know things like that.
Exactly.
And that's what you're going to be looking for probably anyway when your mind takes over under the high stress of an encounter with someone trying to kill you.
Again, that survival positive is to gather as much information about the threat as we possibly can. We're visual creatures. That's how we get information about things. And to short-circuit that by saying, okay, I'm not going to look at that thing that's trying to kill me. Instead, I'm going to focus all my attention and energy and everything else on that little piece of metal at the end of my hand, right? An eighth of an inch wide piece of metal. I'm going to focus all my life on that. I don't honestly believe that that's a great recipe for success. And more importantly, I think when we take a look at our natural threat responses, our instinctive threat responses, those things that are hardwired that we really can't change, right. I really don't think most people are going to do that anyway.
Probably not, and I've been guilty of making too big of a deal of the type of sights I have.
Yeah, that's another part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been guilty of that, and you know, when you think about how people react, and when you think about things like hand-eye coordination, it makes me think of a baseball player trying to hit a baseball that's been pitched 100 miles an hour. You know, are there sights on the bat?
No, of course not.
No. What about a tennis player that's trying to hit a tennis ball that's coming at him 100 miles an hour? There's no, last I checked, there's no sights on a tennis racket.
Or a hockey stick.
Or on a hockey stick, yeah, exactly.
You know, and I tell, and one of the examples that I use is something as mundane as hammering a nail. I mean, do you focus on the head of the hammer and bring it to the nail? No, you focus on the nail, you put that in your center field of vision, and you bring the hammer down to meet the nail. That's how we hammer things, right?
And you want the nail to be in focus.
Exactly.
In fact, you're going to be focusing on the nail and what you're trying to drive it into.
Exactly. And that's how we've evolved to use tools. We've evolved to use tools to look at the work and bring the tool to the work. And you know, again, baseball, tennis, hockey, all of those things, that's what we do. And that's how we've sort of evolved to use these tools. But for some reason, we've got this idea that for this one tool, this one specific tool, we need to do something completely different that's contrary to not only our evolution, but also our instinctive threat reactions.
Yeah, and I, you know, if any of us played like Little League baseball when we were kids, you know, the coach was always saying, keep your eyes on the ball, keep your eyes on the ball, right?
Right.
They're always saying focus on the ball. They want you to focus on what it is that you're trying to hit. And really, shooting is not much different, is it?
No, it really isn't. And if you think about it, you know, let's put it stark example. That's the other thing about it getting old, by the way. You lose your memory. Can't remember.
Oh, man. Tell me about it.
But
what did you say?
Yeah. Who?
Can't remember.
What?
What?
Where am I? If you're making a 3-4 throw in basketball, are you focused on the ball?
No.
No, you're focused on the basket because that's where you want the ball to go. And it's, and that's a direct application to shooting. Okay, I'm going to focus on the basket and I'm going to do that thing that I do, all that coordination and all that other stuff that I do to loft the ball at the right angle, at the right amount of force and the right amount of backspin, all that stuff that you have to do to drop it into the basket. Same thing.
So, Grant, where do you think it all came from that would teach people, hey, you got to have these perfectly focused sights in perfect alignment?
Well, again, I think it came from from the target shooters who had a lot of sway over training, you know, starting in about the 30s, 40s, and up through about the 1980s. And because, and again, when we go back and we look at the specific task involved in bullseye shooting, there it makes sense because, again, we can, we need to reduce our deviation, our error to the greatest degree possible, and we have to focus on reducing both superposition and superimposition errors, both alignment and placement errors. And so we developed that system of that specific target with those specific sights and that specific sight arrangement, that 6 o'clock hold, in order to be able to reduce both of those errors. If we take any of that away, for instance, we have a target that now doesn't have that wonderful big round high contrast thing, that sort of goes out the window. For the game of bullseye, that made a lot of sense, and it works. And
yeah, for that game, but self-defense is not the game of bullseye.
Self-defense is not the game of bullseye. And but we had a lot of people who were sort of trained in that and brought that to the defensive shooting world. And realistically, we don't really know when any given person has a defensive shooting incident. We know today that their memories are incredibly flawed about the incident. In fact, we don't, it's very common now, as I've been told by several lawyers, that we really don't take testimony in court from about these details, and we don't give it the amount of weight that we used to, because we know that the people involved in these things, their memories are sometimes incomplete or flawed, because we don't recall memories, we reconstruct them. We reconstruct them based upon our biases and information we've heard in the meantime and our emotions and all that sort of stuff goes into this big pot. And so we had a lot of people that said, well, I focused on my front sight in this defensive shoot. Well, we don't know that they did because we can't prove it. And in fact, we have a lot of empirical evidence from people that have been through high-level simulations where they've been handed a gun that didn't have any sights on it, and they didn't look the gun over before they got into the simulation. And when questioned later, did you use your sights? I'll say, yeah, by golly, I, you know, focus on my front sight and I made the hits. And, you know, they pull the gun out and say, yeah, you didn't have any sights.
Yeah. So how did you do that, sir?
Yeah. So, you know, when we put all this together, it comes down to the sort of futility of expecting this hard front sight focus in a defensive shooting situation where we're actually reacting to a surprise threat, an ambush sort of threat.
Yeah, and you know, I'm looking at your website now, and I'm looking at your self-defense training part. And by the way, his website's grantcunningham.com. I see you've got threat-centered handgun, threat-centered revolver. What are those?
Well, basically what I do is I took these ideas, and I'm indebted to a lot of people in the business, like Lou Chiodo, like Rob Pincus, all these other guys who have really paved the way in this, and taken that and said, okay, great, let's teach shooting from the standpoint of dealing with the threat, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we're training for. We're not training to do anything but deal with the threat. So let's start with that threat-centered approach to things. And part of that threat-centered approach is the idea of threat focus or target focus. There's a lot of more to it, of course, than that, but we acknowledge the fact that we're going to devote all of our energy, all of our, you know, attention, all of our emotions, all of our intellect to defeating this threat. So if we know we're going to do that, why don't we train that way to begin with?
Yeah, that's good. So these are two classes that you teach, right?
Yeah, in reality, threat-centered revolver and threat-centered handgun are basically the same class. The difference is that the revolver class is limited to revolvers, where the handgun class is open to both revolvers and autoloaders. And the reason I offer a separate revolver class is so that those people who really want to learn as much as they can about using their revolvers in self-defense don't have to put up with me teaching the autoloader people how to clear malfunctions. And I say that half jokingly, but it gives us a chance to really delve into the very fine details of operating a revolver that they might not get otherwise. And there are a few things that I put into that class that I don't put into the handgun class, even when there are revolvers there, because we simply don't have time. But there are a few things that I put in the revolver-only class. And that's actually proven to be very popular. There are a lot of people who have revolvers that they use for self-defense. Either they carry them or maybe they use them at home as a home defense weapon. And they like being able to go to a class and learn all that stuff that they need to and get in a lot more reps with that than they might in a general handgun class.
And to everybody who's listening, you can find all kinds of information about this at grantcunningham.com. That's the primary website you want to go to.
That is, in fact, yes.
That is, in fact. Grant, let's shift gears for a minute, if you don't
sure.
mind. So with this new gun culture that we have now, with so many millions of people now owning guns, many of them owning a gun for the very first time, give us two or three good suggestions that you want to give people who are new at this.
In terms of
a couple things. First of all, what kind of training should they seek out? What should they start doing right away? And well, let's start with that.
I think, and I'm going to probably take some flack from some of the people in the defensive shooting world, because I think one of the things that they really need to do first is, in terms of defensive shooting education, is first of all learn the legalities of it. Mm-hmm. And I think we spend a lot of time talking about how to shoot and how to shoot really well and how to shoot really fast without ever learning when we should shoot or when we can shoot. And there's a big difference between when we can and when we should. There are times when we can shoot that maybe we shouldn't. You know, that the law might excuse us that maybe we really don't need to or maybe we really shouldn't. But it's important to learn what those distinctions are. In other words,
when is it a good idea to shoot?
When is it a good idea? A lot of the problems that I see with defensive shootings come not because the people were bad shooters, but because they made some bad decisions. And most of the time, those decisions are legal in nature. So I think, first of all, learning the legalities are really important. After that, I think it's important to get a good defensive shooting class in that is centered on the idea of dealing with an immediate surprise threat. Because mm-hmm. that's sort of the worst case that we can imagine, is the attack that we did not know was coming ahead of the time that we became aware of it. And that counter ambush sort of training, I think, is very important. And that's very much what I do in Threat Center Revolver, but I'm not the only one. If someone wants to go out and take a combat focused shooting class, which is available across the country, I'm just one guy. There are a whole bunch of guys that teach combat focused shooting. And that is, I think, still the best defensive shooting primer that I think anybody can take, because it deals with that counter ambush shooting. What do I do if I'm surprised when I'm attacked? I think that's important.
Would you agree, Grant, that at least in the beginning of the fight, it's the bad guy that dictates the terms of it?
Yeah, the bad guy is, when he's surprised you, he starts off in control of the situation, and you are reacting to whatever it is he does. You're responding to it. And rather than sort of improvising a response, how about training in a response that is likely to result in you emerging from the incident unscathed?
Mm-hmm. And I like what you brought up earlier when you talked about the legalities. You talked about it in a different way than some people. You know, a lot of people talk about, well, what's going to happen to me legally after the gunfight, which is incredibly important. But what you said is knowing when to shoot, if to shoot, how long to shoot, when to stop shooting.
Right. And that's all part of that legality thing.
Yeah. Or at least, you know, rules of engagement.
Yeah. And, you know, the when we look at defensive shootings and how they're handled in the legal arena, it always comes down to the totality of circumstances. Everybody wants to sort of have this idea that if you do this and this and this, you'll be okay. And if you do this, you won't be okay. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Again, it comes down to the totality of the circumstances and being able to articulate what that totality was, what you perceive because of your training, I think it becomes really important. And it's that legal part of the training that teaches you how to articulate that and why certain things are important and the things that you knew going into it because you have studied this or you've seen it, that kind of thing becomes really, really important.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, just a few more minutes left, Grant, but this has been excellent. In a relatively short time, we've covered a lot of really good information for people to start thinking about. And, you know, I just want to go ahead and throw it out there. Maybe we could do a part two about this one of these days coming up soon.
Oh, I'd love to. That sounds like fun.
Tell people, I'll definitely be inviting you back. Tell people a little bit more about the classes and, you know, maybe there's somebody that, you know, hasn't heard of Grant Cunningham. Of course, I don't know who, but maybe there might be somebody out there that hasn't heard of you. Where can they find you? Where can they find about you?
Well, of course, you can go to grantcunningham.com and there are two great parts about my website. First of course, is the list of classes that I take and the calendar that I have. And I teach around the country. And any of my open enrollment classes will be listed there. Unfortunately, so many of my classes now are closed enrollment where a group will typically bring me in to teach a class for that group, and it'll typically be like a gun club or something. But any of my open enrollment classes will be on there. And I do a few around the country every year. The great part of my website is the news blog. That's my blog, and it's split into self-defense information and just general shooting information. Because I'm a gun guy, you know, I like to go shooting.
Yeah.
But I split those up, and so if you want to read just about self-defense and self-protection, not just with guns, but in the broadest sense of the term, you can look at just those articles. And I've got all kinds of articles going back, like I said, 8 years on all kinds of topics. And there's just a whole pile of stuff there that you can read and get into. And you can sign up for my monthly email updates there as well.
I think I'm going to do that. One quick thing I wanted to ask you. I just thought of this, and ever since I heard it, I've been wanting you to talk a little bit more about it. I think it was when you were on Chaz's Road Gunner podcast not too long ago. You guys got into a discussion about lever-action rifles. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about this forgotten gun, because I think lever actions have been forgotten about with all the AR-15 stuff going on out there. I think it's one of those, you know, it's too bad. It seems like it's a forgotten weapon.
It really is. I grew up with a lever action rifle, as a lot of people out here in the West did. And the lever action has some really important attributes. First of all, the manual of arms, of course, is very obvious and very simple. It's an easy gun to live with in that sense. The second thing is that the guns are nice and light and well balanced, very smooth. You can get them in and out of a safe or in and out of a car easily because there's not a lot of protrusions and magazines and things hanging from them. And a typical lever action rifle, say chambered in .357 Magnum, is going to hold, quite a few rounds, depending upon the length of the barrel, starting at about 9 rounds and going up. And so you actually have pretty good capacity there, and they're easily reloaded, topped off as you shoot. For a defensive tool, either a home defense tool or a homestead defense tool, which I call perimeter defense, mm-hmm. I think that they are a vastly overlooked arm.
Yeah, they are, and they're sweet shooters. They're just so much fun.
They, you know, especially
putting .38 specials into a lever action carbine.
Yeah, there's no recoil. It's like shooting a .22. And they're just a joy to shoot. One of the things that funny people don't understand, if you're shooting an AR-15, if you're shooting anything inside about 15 yards, you have to worry about sight offset because there's a difference between where the sights are and where the bore of the rifle is, and it's typically about mm-hmm. 2 inches. Lever action rifle, you don't have to worry about that because it's like a half inch. So you don't have to worry about, you know, if someone's 5 or 6 yards away, you don't have to worry about, okay, I have to aim 2 inches high to be able to hit my target. It's just, okay, put the sights on where I want it to hit and press the trigger and the bullet goes right where I wanted it to. So in a lot of ways, it's an easier gun for most people who don't train and practice all the time to use.
And I know this is off topic, but I just had to get you to talk about this. You know, 357s in lever action in what, like 18, 20 inch barrel, that's got some pretty serious ballistics, doesn't it?
Yeah, they gain about 500 feet per second over what it will get out of a handgun. And so, and I've said this before, and I mean this in the truest sense of the word, the 357 Magnum is a schizophrenic cartridge because it is it is completely different performance envelope out of a long gun than it is out of a handgun. It's amazing.
I have heard ballistics close to 30-30 ballistics. Is that right?
At the upper end, it gets very close to some of the lighter 30-30s. You know, the 150 grain 30-30s. But yeah, they get fairly close, and it's a gun I use for deer hunting, and it's more than adequate for that. So yeah, they are very overlooked. I think a lot of people sort of write them off. But when you start shooting them and you start taking a look at what they really do, they become a very compelling gun.
Yeah, good. Well, Grant, thanks for taking the time to come on my show, and I appreciate it. And I'll give you the last word. Any other closing thoughts you want to talk about?
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And what I would say is, you know, go to grantcunningham.com, look at my blog, and just read. You can read for hours, for days there. And if you have questions, I'm always open to people just emailing me. They email and ask me all kinds of questions. So please feel free to email me if you have a question about anything that we've talked about here or anything that you see on the blog.
And I'm sure, yeah, where it says contact me, that's probably the easiest way to do it, right?
That's it.
All right. Thank you, Grant. Have a good evening. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Bob. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
A woman is approximately 10 times more likely to be successfully raped when she doesn't have a gun, according to a Department of Justice study. This explains why women in the United States use firearms about 200,000 times a year to stop sexual assaults. It also explains why more than 40% of women own or already have access to a firearm. So why do some politicians want to disarm women? Maybe rape isn't a serious enough crime in their minds. Or maybe they don't want to stare down the wrong end of your barrel.
Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Many thanks, Grant. Wow, I really enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Good stuff. Check out his website, grantcunningham.com. And I think I'm going to try to get to SHOT Show next year. I've always been wanting to go to SHOT Show. And I want to meet Grant. I want to meet several other people in the firearms industry. So I think that's going to be pretty cool. Hey, folks, I want to let you know that Ben Branham and I have set up a class in Alaska, Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced. That's one of the few places that I'm going to travel to this year. I'm going to Houston later this month, February 20th. If you want to take our Beyond Concealed Carry one day and you've never taken it or any kind of a training course, you are going to like it. Just go to handgunworld.com and check out the class reviews page. And you'll see it. John Payne is teaching M4 rifle gunfighting. Suarez International's M4 rifle gunfighting. He's come here to San Antonio the middle of May. Check that out. You can find that at handgunworld.com. I got a new page at my website, which is called Training Classes. Just click that, and you'll see a listing of all these classes. So check that out. We'd like to see you. If you're up in Alaska or you're near Alaska and you'd like to come train with us, we would like to do that. If you're in the Houston area, we got two classes coming up in Houston. And you know what, folks? A lot of you have been supporting me by making your purchases on Amazon. You've been going to the Amazon store every time you want to make a purchase on Amazon, and I appreciate that. If you go to handgunworld.com, click my Amazon store page and just follow the link. It's a real quick three-step process. Let Amazon pay me and support me, and then that way you don't have to spend any extra money at all. How cool is that? And last but not least, if you want to join our Shooters Club, you can get over 50 podcasts worth of exclusive material. About 47 or 48 of them are videos. It's only $8 a month. Think about that, folks. Just about anybody can afford $8 a month, don't you think? I mean, that's nothing. There's a lot of things that you can do to afford $8 a month and learn some great things about using your firearm, defending yourself with your firearm, maintaining your firearm, handguns, rifles, shotguns. Ben and I have it all up there. Just join the Shooters Club. There's a special website you go to. You'll be emailed a password. You can find that at the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. You can also send me a voicemail, 210-646-1727. I'd love to get your feedback. I've gotten a few voicemails in the last week and a half. Next week, folks, I am going to talk about your voicemails. I promise, you know who you are. If you've called in recently, I'm going to get to your voicemails, I promise, next week. Go ahead and call some more in if you guys want. 210-646-1727. That's it, folks. Remember, evil doesn't exist in the holster. It exists in the hearts of men and women. Shoot straight, shoot safe. I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Hey, did you go to SHOT Show?
Yes, I did.
Was it good?
Well, yeah. I'm a little biased because a project that I worked on for several years got introduced at SHOT Show. The Kimber K6S revolver is a project that I worked on with Kimber, and I was part of the development team, and that got introduced there. So that was like a highlight for me. If nothing else happened, it would have been a great show.
Yeah.
That of course was great. It was the talk of the show. I think that's just about all anybody was talking about. It was kind of
it made your entire show worth it.
It was great. There wasn't a lot. There just wasn't a lot new introduced at this SHOT Show, but there was a real. There was an atmosphere of everything was upbeat. I remember last year and the year before, things were kind of, everybody's kind of down in the dumps because, ammo was hard to get and there were lots of, anti-gun bills being proposed not only in the Congress but in state legislatures and, all this and the AR-15 market had collapsed. Nobody was buying AR-15s. And so there was just kind of a doldrums the last couple of years. And this year, everybody was just upbeat. Everybody was excited, despite the fact that there wasn't a lot new, but still people were excited. It was a good show.
Good. Well, it's my goal to get there next year. I've never been, and I'm excited about getting there next January.
Oh, you should, and because you can generate so much show material there.
I know. Well, everybody's coming out with all these SHOT Show podcasts, and I'm one of the few that doesn't have one.
Yeah. If you don't make it, and if you want to do a, from the SHOT Show podcast, let me know and we'll get together and we'll record one on Wednesday or Thursday of the show so that you can put it out right away if you'd like to do that, if you don't make it.
If I don't make it, I'll take you up on that. Thank you, Grant.
All right. You bet, Bob.
Have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.